emeritus professor at Westchester University. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tavoy and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. إِنَّ رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية ادعوا ربكم إنه لا يحب المعتدين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's leader says the West will not hesitate to further extend its influence wherever it can, noting the ongoing conflict in Ukraine stems from the West's attempt to expand NATO. Colombia's leftist politician Gustavo Petro wins presidency on the promise to bring about profound social and economic changes in the country. And U.S. lawmakers remain divided on reaching a deal on gun safety amid calls for urgent action to reduce violence following two mass shootings last month. Hello and welcome. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has blamed NATO expansionism for the war in Ukraine, saying Western powers will not hesitate to expand their sphere of influence wherever possible. In a meeting with the visiting Kazakh president, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, he urged vigilance in the face of relentless U.S. attempts to undermine the sovereignty and might of countries, particularly in Eastern and Western Asia. The leader also pointed to the deep historical and cultural ties between Iran and Kazakhstan and called for the greater expansion of cooperation between the two countries, in particular, regionally. He said the two sides must redouble efforts to follow through and implement their agreements. For his part, Qasem Jomart Tokayev hailed his talks with the Iranian president earlier in the day. He said the documents signed between the two sides can pave the ground for the enhancement of bilateral ties. Earlier, we were joined by political commentator Kent Stone to get his take on the remarks by Iran's leader about NATO's expansionism. He says expansion of the military alliance is an extension of U.S. hegemonic policies. Have a listen.
The Supreme Leader was right to say that the U.S. and NATO are always looking for openings in which to exploit, in which to extend the U.S. Desire for hegemony over the entire globe. And when he referred to Ukraine, the Supreme Leader was correct there as well, because he pointed out that the military conflict in Ukraine was caused by NATO. It was caused by NATO's relentless expansion starting in the 1990s after the dissolution of the former Soviet Union, when James Baker, the former U.S. Secretary of State, and other NATO leaders gave a promise in writing and verbally to Mikhail Gorbachev, the last Soviet president, that NATO would not expand even one inch eastward of a reunited Germany. Of course, they lied, and they deliberately lied, and NATO has expanded 800 kilometers eastward since then in the last 30 years. NATO has the ambition to do to the Russian Federation what it did to the former Yugoslavian Federation, and that is to defeat it militarily and then break it into its component parts, the better to gobble it up. All the countries that NATO has hacked since 1990, Afghanistan, Yugoslavia, Iraq, Libya, these are all pawns in their game, these countries.
President of the Republic of Kazakhstan, Qasem Jomart Tokayev, has paid a visit to Iran to cement ties with the Islamic Republic. Yusuf Jaloudi reports from the Iranian capital.
A warm welcome for a new chapter in the Iran-Kazakhstan relations. On Sunday, Kazakh President Qasem Jomart Tokayev arrived in Tehran at the invitation of his Iranian counterpart, Ebrahim Raisi. After an hour-long meeting, the two sides oversaw the signing of several cooperation documents on transport, energy, and tourism, among other areas.
Despite the existing geopolitical situation and restrictions, Kazakhstan and Iran managed to increase their bilateral trade by 50% over the past 3 months. With today's MOUs, I'm certain that we will achieve a lot more in our interactions.
Iran was the first country that recognized Kazakhstan's independence following the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991. That was when Tehran and Nur Sultan began their diplomatic ties. President Raisi says the two nations have never been closer.
This visit by the honorable Kazakh president is undoubtedly a milestone in Iran-Kazakhstan relations. Over the past 30 years, we have maintained fraternal ties with our neighbor, Kazakhstan, but the level of our relations need to be enhanced.
Iran and Kazakhstan are both members of the Economic Cooperation Organization, ECO. This provides a safe trading channel for the two countries, without worries over the impacts of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
We need to expand our cooperation through regional organizations such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the Eurasian Economic Union.
Since he took office less than a year ago, President Raisi has been trying to establish closer neighborly ties, as he believes this would obviate the need for Iran to wait for the fate of the ailing 2015 deal with the world powers to improve its economy.
Before the coronavirus pandemic, Iran and Kazakhstan's annual trade exceeded $1 billion. But the pandemic pushed this figure down to around $200 million. Today, the two presidents vowed to push the envelope of their country's commercial interaction and set a $3 billion mark for their annual trade. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghan Center for Strategic and Regional Studies has held a seminar in Kabul to discuss the future of relations between Afghanistan and its neighboring countries. Rahmatullah Bahman reports from the Afghan capital.
Afghanistan, the axis of regional stability and cooperation, is the title of this seminar that hosts political figures and experts from Afghanistan and neighboring countries. The event aims to discuss ways Afghanistan and neighboring countries can boost peace and integration in the region.
Afghanistan has experienced almost four decades of war, conflict, and invasion. But with recent political changes, the country is opening a new chapter in its history. Therefore, Afghanistan's priorities, policy, and engagement must be reviewed. Our relations with neighbors is one of the elements of regional stability and development. New Afghan rulers must boost ties and dialogues with regional states to prevent the foreign powers from another interference and invasion.
Representatives from neighboring countries also announced their readiness for providing needed assistance for the Afghan nation, stressing the need for lasting peace in Afghanistan.
Iran and Afghanistan have had long bilateral relations in different areas, especially in the health sector. Iran has helped the Afghan nation with establishing clinics and hospitals across Afghanistan, as well as providing medicines. Iran is also training Afghan doctors and health staff inside Afghanistan or giving them scholarships for Iranian universities.
In the meantime, Taliban leaders attending the seminar say that Afghanistan is strongly in favor of promoting regional cooperation in different fields.
The Islamic Emirate is committed to establish positive and fair relations with regional countries, especially our neighbors. In return, we expect the world and regional countries to help Afghans and Afghanistan. Talking about potential cooperation opportunities, I should say that Afghanistan is a bridge in the region. If they assist us, we can establish air corridors or construct streets and railways to help promote regional trade.
The Taliban-led interim government has not yet been recognized by world countries, but the neighbors of Afghanistan have held several meetings to emphasize the need for stability in Afghanistan and helping Afghan people. After decades of war, Afghanistan is stepping into a new era, gearing up for regional integration and cooperation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Bahrain has officially set up a full diplomatic mission in Syria over a decade after its last ambassador left the country. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad received the credentials of Ambassador Wahid Mubarak Sayyar in an official ceremony on Sunday. Sayyar was appointed in December, 4 years after Bahrain reopened its embassy in Damascus. Bahrain and the UAE have tried to normalize ties with Syria after they cut ties with Damascus in the wake of the war that broke out in 2011. The conflict, fueled by some of their allies, has left hundreds of thousands of Syrians dead. The Palestinian Prime Minister has called on Israel to hand over the gun that fired the shot which killed veteran journalist Shireen Abu Akleh last month. Mohammed Shataya made the remark during a ceremony held in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah to commemorate Abu Akleh. He rejected any Israeli investigation into the journalist's killing, stressing that Israel could not be trusted. Shataya said Palestinian authorities have not delivered the bullet extracted from Abu Akleh's body to the Israeli regime. Israel had demanded Palestinians hand over the bullet, claiming it's needed for a probe into the killing. A Palestinian probe has already found that an Israeli soldier shot dead the journalist who was wearing a vest marked with the word press. Abu Akleh was killed while she was covering an Israeli raid in the West Bank city of Jenin. Her killing sparked repeated calls for international bodies to investigate Israel's crimes against Palestinians. Colombia's leftist politician Gustavo Petro has won presidency on the promise to bring about profound social and economic changes in the country. Petro, a former mayor of capital Bogota, beat his businessman rival Rodolfo Hernandez in a tense and unpredictable election. With the vote count complete, Petro won with 50.5% compared to 47.3% for Hernandez, a gap of more than 700,000 votes. Hernandez conceded defeat after poll results were announced. Petro will succeed the unpopular conservative Ivan Duque, who was barred by Colombia's constitution from running for election. The voting took place as the country is plagued by the economic fallout from the COVID pandemic and social unrest. Public dissatisfaction triggered massive protests in Colombia last year. Our correspondent Camila Escalante says the Colombian president-elect is very likely to cause a major shift in the country's foreign policy. Have a listen.
But we will see definitely a change of direction because this coalition, the Pacto Histórico, that has elected and brought into power Gustavo Petro, has not seen eye to eye with the government of Iván Duque on many issues. So we're seeing a completely different vision that they've been promoting throughout this campaign, a different vision on how to interact with the United States, with Washington, a different vision on how to go about the implementation of the peace accords and how to go about responding to the human rights crisis and the high levels of violence and drug trafficking and other crime that we see in Colombia. So right now, what we are waiting for is for the president-elect to come out and speak to these huge crowds of supporters. There are celebrations taking place all across Colombia right now. Right off the bat, we heard some of these progressive and leftist leaders from around our continent come out on social media to extend their congratulations to Gustavo Petro and Francia Márquez. That includes President Nicolas Maduro, President of Venezuela, as well as Luis Arce of Bolivia, Miguel Díaz-Canel, the President of Cuba, and many, many others have extended their congratulations and have said that they look forward to building a more integrated, peaceful region now with this new government.
Lawmakers in the United States remain divided on reaching a deal on gun safety as pressure mounts to reduce gun violence following two mass shootings last month. Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee said after asking to see the textual content of a potential agreement, it became apparent that, quote, there still is no deal. He said a bipartisan group of lawmakers have an agreement on a series of, quote, very broad promises. Lee also called for additional, quote, transparency to deal with the controversial matter. Last week, the lead Republican negotiator in the Senate tasked with crafting a gun safety bill walked out of the talks. This against the backdrop of a Texas elementary school shooting in May when 19 children and two teachers were killed. Another gunman at a New York supermarket killed 10 black people. Final results of France's parliamentary elections show President Emmanuel Macron's alliance has lost its absolute majority. Full vote count results published by the Interior Ministry show Macron's alliance has won 245 seats in the 577-member parliament. That means the alliance is well short of the 289 seats needed for an overall majority. The left-wing NUPES coalition, which is led by leftist politician Jean-Luc Mélenchon, has won 135 seats. Addressing his supporters, Mélenchon said the vote results were, quote, totally unexpected and unseen. He added his camp succeeded in its goal to deprive Macron of his parliamentary majority. Finally, far-right leader Marine Le Pen's National Rally Party has managed to send 89 MPs to the National Assembly.
French President Emmanuel Macron's coalition has been reprimanded at the ballot box in the second round legislative vote, failing to secure an absolute majority. However, he and the longtime Conservative Party are expected to continue to unite on neoliberal policies, and combined, they will control over half of parliament, with initial projections giving them 53%.
This is a country which is difficult to govern, with a lot of different demands. I don't see there being a big change for the average person over the next 5 years, but I do foresee a lot of difficulties.
In his first term, Macron routinely forced policies through by executive decree, even though he had a comfortable absolute majority, causing many to see the legislative vote as an empty formality. Thus, turnout reached just 46%, making abstention the real Democratic majority winner.
Voter participation was far from excellent, unfortunately. Hopefully, it won't hurt the credibility of the government when it comes to implementing reform.
The biggest winner was the far-right National Front, who more than doubled most poll predictions with around 90 seats, making them the third largest power in parliament and tripling their best score ever. When the results were announced, their election headquarters immediately chanted, "Macron resign," and they will likely play an unpredictable role in mainstream politics. The left-wing NUPES, Popular Front Alliance, promised much and under-delivered. With only 25% of seats, they are the main opposition party, but are small enough to be easily brushed aside by the right wing. The new kingmakers are the mainstream conservative party, but Macron's record of legalizing Islamophobia, far-right economic policies, often passed via authoritarian decree, and his brutal repression of the Yellow Vests has caused many to say for years that Macron is actually a mainstream conservative, but with a new party logo. Despite a prolonged period of once-in-a-century social unrest, the French political landscape has barely been changed. If essentially the same people in power don't change how they govern, many say the next 5 years could be dangerously explosive. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
And with that report, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Thank you for your company. Stay with us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Limelight. New scientific research published recently shows the waters in the North Barren Sea are warming at a rate that is much more rapid than most climate models have predicted, with worrying implications about feedback loops for the larger Arctic region and far beyond. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by John Coley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Off the Scale, Warmer Arctic Ocean Fueling Climate Feedback Loop Faster Than Previously Known. Here's more. New scientific research published recently shows the waters in North Barren Sea are warming at a rate that is much more rapid than most climate models have predicted, with worrying implications about feedback loops for the larger Arctic region and far beyond. Extending between the north coast of Norway and Russia in the eastern Arctic Ocean, the North Barren Sea has been warming at a rate nearly 7 times that of the global average, this study shows. The researchers used temperature data over 4 decades to determine that the trends in the region, the fastest warming place known on Earth, should be seen as an early warning of what could happen elsewhere. Published in Scientific Reports, the new findings offer further confirmation that feedback loops in the Arctic are taking hold, but could be doing so at a faster rate than previously understood. The warming pattern is primarily consistent with reductions in sea ice cover and confirms the general, spatial, and temporal patterns represented by reanalysis, states the abstract of the study, adding, however, our findings suggest even a stronger rate of warming and sea ice concentration and sea surface temperature relation than was known in this region until now. Researchers behind the study reports High North News warn the increased warming is likely to fuel increases in extreme weather in North America, Europe, and Asia. The scientists say the Barents Sea region offers a window into how warming is already impacting the Arctic more broadly and what more rapid warming can look like elsewhere in the future. We expected to see strong warming, but not on the scale we found. Ketil Isaken, a senior researcher at the Norwegian Meteorological Institute who led the study, told The Guardian. "We were all surprised," he added. "We were surprised from what we know from all other observation points on the globe. These are the highest warming rates we have observed so far," he said. "The broader message is that the feedback of melting sea ice is even higher than previously shown. This is an early warning for what's happening in the rest of the Arctic if this melting continues and what is most likely to happen in the next decades." Bill McGuire, Emeritus Professor of Geographical and Geophysical Climate Hazards at the University of College London, said the findings were among the most dire he's ever seen. While land surface temperatures are rising and oceans warming across the globe, Isaacson said his team's research helps show what's happening in the far northeast of the scale. As The Guardian reports, it was already known that the climate crisis was driving heating across the Arctic 3 times faster than the global average, but the new research shows the situation is even more extreme in places. Sea ice is good at reflecting sunlight, but is melting away. This allows the darker ocean below to absorb more energy. Losing sea ice also means it no longer restricts the ability of warmer sea waters to heat up the Arctic air. The more ice is lost, the more heat accumulates, forming a feedback loop. According to Dr. Ruth Mutarum, a climate scientist at the Danish Meteorological Institute, who was not part of the research team, this study shows that even the best possible models have been underestimating the rate of warming in the Barents Sea. "We seem to be seeing it shifting to a new regime as it becomes less like the Arctic and more like the North Atlantic," she told The Guardian. "It's really on the edge right now, and it seems unlikely that sea ice will persist in this region for much longer."
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, in light of the Iranian Foreign Minister's visit to India, we'll assess the opportunities and challenges ahead for the development of ties between the two nations. We'll also take a look at the worldwide protests of the Muslim community to derogatory comments made by BJP officials against the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and their implications for India.
On the 8th of June, the Iranian foreign minister, accompanied by a high-ranking delegation, visited New Delhi to meet with Indian politicians, trade officials, and other notable dignitaries. During this visit, the two sides held extensive talks discussing various fields of interest, which showcased the willingness of both parties to expand ties on all fronts. Creating a blueprint for long-term cooperation between the two countries is one of the main objectives of this visit, apart from discussing recent global and regional developments, a goal that appears more necessary than ever in the aftermath of the economic stagnation that occurred in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, is solving conflicts in Europe and the global food and energy crisis.
Looking at historical context, Iran and India have maintained long-lasting ties, but these ties have been subjected to global and regional developments of recent decades, causing a fluctuation in bilateral relations. India is a newly emerging superpower that the IMF predicts will become the third global economic powerhouse by 2025, after the US and China. The requirement for long-term energy supplies as the fourth consumer of oil after China, US, and Russia means it cannot ignore Iran, which holds the world's second-largest reserve of natural gas and the third-largest oil reserves. 2 days before his speech at GlobeSec 2022 in Bratislava, Jaishankar stated, "If the US and Europe want to limit other countries' imports from Russia, they must bring Iran and Venezuela as alternative import options back to the table." From another perspective, access to countries in West Asia, Europe, and the Persian Gulf is an important objective for India that can be best achieved through Iran. The visit by the Iranian foreign minister and his accompanying delegation and the talks held with high-ranking Indian officials come at a time when the global food and energy crisis caused by the Russia-Ukraine war is heralding new challenges for India, like many other nations. On the other hand, a balanced approach to foreign policy and mutual political security and economic interests necessitates the furthering of ties between Iran and India if they aim to achieve mutual goals.
India considers Iran a significant supplier of energy and a bridge to reach Afghanistan, West Asia, and Europe. For the Islamic Republic, India is one of the countries that can help Iran achieve its look to the east policy. Meanwhile, shared concerns for security in Afghanistan and Central Asia, along with India's policy to balance relations between the east and the west, have made Iran a focal point in India's global and regional politics.
We can trace India's interest in Central Asia to the economic and cultural exchanges along the ancient Silk Road. These exchanges that include all aspects of politics, economy, and culture in conjunction with India-Pakistan's deteriorating ties have arguably made Chabahar port the best, or perhaps the only viable access point for India in its attempts to reach Afghanistan and other Central Asian countries. Moreover, access to Europe and increasing India's influence and power in the Persian Gulf and West Asia would prove most difficult without proper cooperation and coordination with Iran. In pursuit of clear geopolitical and geoeconomic gains, especially when it comes to the Chabahar project, the Indian government has inked several cooperation agreements with Iran over the past two decades. The Chabahar port is one of the main variables that can lead to improved economic relations and subsequently the formation of a lasting political link between Iran, India, and Afghanistan, a link that New Delhi seems to pursue as one of its priorities in its policies toward the new Iranian government.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Karim Sharara, an Iranian affairs expert from Beirut, Lebanon. Now, Mr. Sharara, welcome to the program. Now, considering furthering political and economic ties can be beneficial to both Iran and India, how do you assess the prospects of cooperation between the two nations?
Okay, I think both countries stand to gain a lot from cooperation with one another. On the one hand, of course, Iran, as President Raisi has said time and time again, is trying to increase its cooperation with its neighboring countries. So on the one hand, you have the relationship with the Axis of Resistance, or countries that are that have very strong relations with Iran. So we're talking here about Iraq, Syria, and the strategic depth that Iran has in the region, in West Asia, I mean. And on the other hand, you also have Central Asia, which, I mean, I'm just talking about where Iran is concerned at the moment. So we're talking Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and of course, we're talking about China. Now, there's a lot we can talk, we can say about China, but as far as India is concerned, India is one of the most important countries in the world right now after China. And of course, it isn't just fine with remaining a super or a very strong regional power close to superpower status in South Asia. Increase its clout in Central Asia. One of the impediments towards that relationship, towards it attaining that status, is Pakistan, on the one hand, and the problems it shares with India. So, if India has to wants to become a more influential country, it needs to cooperate with the region's countries. Now, of course, it also has problems with China. And so it needs to further its clout on the economic level with countries in Asia. And Iran happens to be very well located at the geographic level. So naturally, India will have to pick up or increase its relations with Iran.
Now, Mr. Sharara, how does the West view this visit by the Iranian foreign minister to India and its implications and its tensions over their stance on Ukraine?
Okay, as far as the West goes, of course, they're not in favor of India picking up with relations with Iran. Of course, it's not within their interests. They want an isolated Iran, and they don't want India having anything to do with it. However, look, if you go back to recent history, relations between India with Iran have been very formal. There hasn't been a lot of follow through, even though both countries have signed many agreements with one another. So if you look at this recent history, you realize that that this follow through is a lot of it is because of U.S. pressure or because many Indian companies are afraid of the possibility of sanctions. So, okay, they're up to signing agreements with Iran so that they can secure a possible future. But the fear of sanctions has them keeping a step behind, so to speak. So the West naturally doesn't look favorably upon any improvement in relations between Iran and India.
Now, Mr. Sharara, you've mentioned the sanctions. Now, will sanctions affect the extent of trade and economic development, or does this willingness to expand ties signal another blow to U.S. and EU attempts at controlling the global market?
Okay, as far as sanctions go, as I just said, there's a lot of fear of sanctions from India, and this has kept both countries from taking their ties up to a new level. When you have so many agreements that haven't been implemented, with Indian companies afraid of investing in the Iranian market for fear of U.S. sanctions, this shows you how the impact of the sanctions has been an impediment. It's been impeding the progress of relations between the two countries. However. The readiness of the fact that Amir Abdullahian has visited India, this in and of itself signifies that India is prepared to overcome some of its problems with the EU and the or some of the implications that this may cause with the EU and the US, because as I said, the US and the EU are currently preoccupied with Ukraine. And also, India has to reinforce its Asian depth, its Asian identity. I mean, of course, India is a huge market for the West, and the West needs it more than India needs the West, first of all. Second of all, after the problems that have happened with Ukraine and the fact that India was prepared to stand up to the West in order to secure or keep its relations secure with Russia and to a larger extent with its neighbors in Central Asia, this shows that we're now seeing, hopefully, what can be the beginning of a restructuring in Indian foreign policy, hopefully. Unless the West is able to exert additional pressure in order to keep India from doing this.
Thank you, Mr. Sharara, for being on the program. Now, let's see what people had to say on social media.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi hails the centuries-old civilizational links between India and Iran and notes that relations between the two countries have promoted regional security and prosperity. Dr. S. Jaishankar, India's foreign minister, following his meeting with Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian, says both sides reviewed bilateral cooperation, including in trade, connectivity, health, and people-to-people ties. Financial securities analyst Sanjeev Basin points to growing cooperation between Iran and India by citing the report about first transfer of Russian goods to India through a new trade corridor that transits Iran.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Offensive remarks made by two BJP officials about the Prophet of Islam and the inevitable wrath of Muslims seems to threaten India's political and economic ties with Muslim countries. A real risk that could prove detrimental to its economic ties with key trade partners and the main energy supplies for the nation. Shortly after their insults, BJP national spokesperson Nupur Sharma and Naveen Kumar Jindal, who is the chief of the party's media cell, apologized for their comments. Nupur Sharma was suspended and Naveen Kumar was expelled from the party. But the wrath of the Muslim community, which has been facing discrimination and hate campaigns for years, led to violent protests across the country.
Offensive remarks by Nupur Sharma, BJP's national spokesperson, during a televised debate and Naveen Jindal's controversial social media post on religious values were followed by worldwide condemnation by Muslims. India witnessed unprecedented public outcry. From East to West Asia, the Persian Gulf and Northern Africa, India's ambassadors were summoned and official statements were issued by various countries condemning the acts of sacrilege and requesting decisive action by the Indian government. The Organization for Islamic Cooperation said in a statement, "These cases of defamation are part of a growing spate of hatred and defamation of Islam in India and systematic practices against Indian Muslims, particularly in light of a set of decisions to prohibit the use of hijab in educational institutions in some Indian states, including demolition of Muslims' properties and growing violence against them." Later, the Indian Foreign Ministry released a statement rejecting the offensive comments and tweets, stressing that these are the views of individuals and do not represent the values of the Indian government. But all the efforts made by BJP officials failed to suppress the public outcry of Muslims and stop nationwide protests. Thousands of Muslims in India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and other Muslim countries took to the streets to protest. The protests led to violence in India, leaving few dead and dozens injured, adding to India's long history of anti-Islam sentiments. Thousands of commentators had predicted that the pressure would lead to Muslims' reprisals, which can lead to a new series of ethnic and religious tensions.
The founders of a free India, including Jawaharlal Nehru, made the right decision to create a secular state, and one of the reasons for the decision was to accommodate the plethora of ethnic and religious identities in the nation. But since the BJP came into power, discriminatory and extremist policies implemented against Muslims have created a tense atmosphere in the country. Despite the emphasis of the Indian constitution on its secular nature, pressures against the Muslim minority seem to be intensifying as of late. They started with the implementation of extremist regulations against religious minorities, but have led to beating and even killing of Muslims and the demolition of the houses by extremists.
Muslims form 13% of India's total population. This 200 million strong population that has peacefully coexisted with other religious communities has become alienated from the rest of the nation following British colonialist rule and their policy of divide and conquer. This divide was exacerbated by the rise of the BJP and the parties provoking anti-Muslim sentiments in the public, leading to animosity from the minority Muslim population. Judging by the Babri Mosque case and the annexation of Kashmir's administrative authority, the Indian nationality law increased pressure against women wearing hijab, and thousands of small instances of harassment of Muslims, a re-evaluation of the performance of Indian officials when it comes to harassment of minorities, seems inevitable. In the recent case of insults against sacred values of Muslims on India's media and social media platforms, the issue has been stretched beyond religious disputes among the nation, becoming a global issue. Analysts believe that the party's reaction to the issue will not be sufficient, and if senior members of the Indian government and its ruling party fail to present an appropriate public response, their ties with other Muslim countries may become undone. 57 members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation have demanded decisive action by the Indian government to discipline those who insulted the Prophet. If a $90 billion trade agreement with the Gulf Cooperation Council in 2020 to 2021 is at risk, not to mention the work and livelihood of millions of Indians living in its member states, India will be facing a serious challenge on its path to becoming a global powerhouse, because it will need the energy supply and the export market.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Clifton de Rosario, General Secretary at All India Lawyers Association for Justice. Mr. Rosario, welcome to the program. Now, the protests in response to the derogatory comments against Prophet Muhammad have taken India by storm, but is this backlash unexpected after the continuous harassment of Muslims across the country?
Okay. What we're witnessing right now, what we're witnessing right now in our country is really posing some very crucial questions of our nation in terms of how we go forward from here, what the idea of this country is going to be. And I think, one really shouldn't be too surprised. The Islamophobic statements that were made, the kind of bigotry that we are seeing, the targeting of the Muslims in a sense, which basically is premised on the understanding that Muslims and other minorities, as has always been the case with Dalits, are second-class citizens in this country. That message that is being sought to be drilled into the daily lives of Muslims by state and non-state actors, this, I think, is an extremely challenging time, as it were. And obviously, the Muslim community is not taking this lying down, and they are responding to it. The kind of protest that we saw when the government tried to force down the Citizenship Amendment Act down the throats of people over here.
Mr. Rosario, we know that the Muslim community in India has been discriminated against since the BJP came into power, but after the suspension of anti-Islam political figures, do you think the political pressure is finally working?
The fact that, the BJP national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, and the party's, BJP's Delhi media head, Naveen Kumar Jindal, could so brazenly such vicious Islamophobic statements is something that I think we have to really take note of. It reflects the kind of bigotry that is running amok in our country. In that sense, it was obvious that, you know, there was going to be some kind of a public outrage against it, as also some kind of international pressure as well. And no doubt, we saw that, you know, several states, whether it's Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Malaysia, etc., who all came out in strong condemnation of it. And of course, the threat at that point was the boycott of Indian goods. That seemed to have, you know, played a big role in the government that's taking the, you know, coming out with the statement that these are fringe elements. And then, of course, you know, just throwing, expelling them from the party. One really needs to read between the lines over here. How can they be called fringe? In fact, right now, the slogan that is going across the country is that gali gali mein shor hai, fringe nahi ye core hai. That means everybody knows for sure that these so-called fringe are actually the core. So what both of them have said is something that is being said every day in the media. It is being said in the hate speeches, in the Dharam Sansads. It's being said all across the country.
Mr. Razavia, Muslim countries have condemned the many cases of Islamophobia-fueled comments by BJP officials and demanded an appropriate response by the government. So how can the BJP government mend the damage caused by its anti-Islam policies?
I'm just saying that I'm a little surprised at how people are trying to see this. The point is that if you were to look at the situation of the Muslim community in India, say from an economic sense, and you have the Rajinder Sachar report, which was brought in when the previous UPA was in power, which basically talks about the extremely vulnerable economic situation of the Muslim community. Now, added to that, you have this virulent attack on the being of the Muslim itself. So whether it's the hijab, whether it's a Muslim street vendor, whether it is COVID, every single context is being communalized. Every single situation is being used for communal polarization. So indeed, you know, this is an extremely, extremely serious situation. But the point is that the pressure that we are talking about comes only at a particular point. Now, from 2014, we have witnessed the lynchings of Muslims. But unfortunately, that did not create that kind of a huge outcry. So the targeting of the Muslims has been happening, you can say, from 2014. It is completely heightened. There's no two ways about it. But there hasn't been any that kind of a corresponding international pressure on the Indian state for it to, push back from its agenda. Its core agenda is this. Alongside this crony capitalist agenda of it, one of its core agenda is anti-minority.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Clifton de Rosario for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's go to social media to see what people had to say.
Ashok Swain, an academic and analyst, says massive protests have broken out in India, Bangladesh and Pakistan over derogatory remarks about Prophet Muhammad by India's Hindu right-wing regime officials. Pakistan's former human rights minister, Shirin Mazari, asks why is the OIC not calling a special session to deal with the BJP spokesperson's blasphemous remarks and targeting of protesting Muslims. Khalid Beydoun, a law professor and author, calls on the Arab governments to use their power and influence to prevent state terror being unleashed against Indian Muslims.
And that was our episode on the prospects and challenges of economic cooperation between Iran and India, and the domestic, regional and global consequences of insulting the Holy Prophet of Islam. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
In the limelight. In Britain, human rights campaigners are saying an appalling pilot scheme treats those fleeing conflict and persecution as criminals. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Anna McSwan. The piece is titled "People Arriving in UK on Small Boats to be Electronically Tagged." In Britain, refugee rights campaigners have described a new Home Office scheme to electronically tag asylum seekers as appalling, saying the move treats people fleeing conflict and persecution as criminals. Under a 12-month pilot scheme, which began on Wednesday, 15th of June, some people arriving in the United Kingdom in small boats or in the back of lorries will be electronically tagged. Critics say the draconian move will do nothing to stop people from taking risky journeys to reach the United Kingdom in search of asylum. Prime Minister Boris Johnson defended the plans on Saturday morning, saying it was essential that people did not simply vanish into the rest of the country. Under the plans, asylum seekers will have to regularly report in person to authorities and may be subject to a curfew or excluded from certain locations, while failure to do so could result in them being returned to detention or prosecuted in courts of law. Enver Solomon, the chief executive of the Refugee Council, said it's appalling that this government is intent on treating men, women and children who have fled war, bloodshed and persecution as criminals. This draconian and punitive approach not only shows no compassion for very vulnerable people, it will also do nothing to deter those who are desperately seeking safety in the United Kingdom. The Prime Minister Boris Johnson speaking to reporters at RAF Bryce Norton after returning from an unannounced visit to Kiev in Ukraine said, "This is a very, very generous, welcoming country. Quite right too. I'm proud of it. But when people come here illegally, when they break the law, it is important that we make that distinction. That is what we're doing with our Rwanda policy. That is what we're doing with making sure..."